There are a number of ironies attending this presentation. Not the less, we're being bound up with the very topic of address as well as its mode. I titled this talk, Annotations to be Performed for a Talk on Acidia, December of 2007. Quite a long time ago, I wrote a dissertation on a rather obscure figure named Evagrius Ponticus, an ascetic who lived in North Africa in the monastic community at Skete, in the period that we now commonly refer to as Late Antiquity. One of the primary axes of my thesis, which operated under the influence, as well as the direction of Michel Foucault, was an examination of the relation and evolution of free speech, paresia, to the various arts of persuasion. Since paresia and rhetoric share the same root, rhema, and they have an intricate and long-standing relation of complicity and resistance, it was an area of inquiry that was extensive enough and also had certain precise demarcations, an analysis of certain aspects of counterposition of free speech unencumbered by guile or artifice, opposed to rhetorical modes of address and effect, enough certainly to accommodate my research interests. While my studies range from the 4th century BC, Euripides, Socrates, Plato, Alcibiades, to the time of Rabelais, my primary focus was on the late 6th century, and my primary area of inquiry centered upon the analysis of a polemical tract written by Evagrius, one which has survived under the title of Antirrheticus. I had hoped to prepare a modern edition and apparatus of this text in conjunction with my dissertation. Both remain unfinished. I had made a public presentation of parts of this material only twice, once at the University of California in Berkeley and once in France, both at the instigation of Foucault. So, when the topic of the seven deadly sins came up early on in conversation with the organizers of this event, I had recalled that a certain part of my own investigations had uncovered the intriguing claim that the original author of the seven deadly sins was none other than Evagrius Ponticus, although Evagrius had initially proposed that there would be eight deadly sins. Curiously enough, it was acidia, sloth, that had been split so that a sharp distinction was drawn between spiritual sloth acidia and corporeal acidia, bodily sloth. There are many complex reasons for this, which I won't go into. It was at the hands of the close successors of Evagrius, most specifically John Cassian, that the familiar configuration of the seven deadly sins was wrought and has come into our tradition. So, when I was asked to make a small presentation on the topic, I was pleased with this prospect of returning to the body of work by now lying in some metaphorical shoebox stuffed under an equally metaphorical bed or some other bit of furniture or appliance. So giving a talk in public on Evagrius was something I immediately agreed to. But I knew it was going to be a bit tight, since I'd already committed to a schedule of talks and seminars in Brussels that week. As you will note, I am still in Brussels. Unforeseen exigencies have tampered with my itinerary. I'm still here, and of course, my shoebox full of shards and fragments of what I hope was not to be too boring an examination of Evagrius on sloth is somewhere in Brooklyn, where I live. So, among the ironies of this address is that I shall have to construct and perform what can only amount to a series of annotations and suggestions for further inquiry based on memory. But the relation between memory and acidia is a very interesting one, with complicated intersections and contiguities. For example, in the register of surviving texts which mark transitions from orality to written cultures, one often finds evidence of a complaint, ironically in written form, that writing, since it is a form of laziness or indolence, produces a slowness of thinking and of speaking, which is symptomatic of a radical and distressing diminution of cultural traditions, forms of communication, interaction, and life. And by inscribing memory, the ars memoria, to an external vessel, a prosthetic or artificial memory produces a grievous wound upon the body, social and private, a sin, in a certain sense. This is another irony for me, since the topic of my set of lectures in Brussels this week has been prosthetic memory, technical reproducibility, and generative media. I may, less through a certain form of laziness on my part than from a sense of making an appropriate intervention, insert some of that material into today's conversation. We'll see. Such promises have a way of going awry. At the beginning of one of his books, Giorgio Agamben writes, "Every written work can be regarded as the prologue, or rather the broken cast of a work never penned, and destined to remain so because later works, which in turn will be the prologues or the molds of other absent works, represent only sketches or death masks. The absent work, although it is unplaceable in any precise chronology, thereby constitutes the written work as prolegomena or paralipomena of a non-existent text, or in a more general sense as parerga, which find their true meaning only in the context of an illegible ergon. To take Montaigne's fine image, these are the frieze of grotesque around an unpainted portrait, or, in the spirit of the pseudo-Platonic letter, the counterfeit of a book which cannot be written. Beginnings, of course, may be wrought, this is the end of quote, beginnings may be wrought, of course, of citations, fragments of another absent text taking place within a text, marking in the same gesture the finitude and the incompletability of reference, the presence and absence of what it is, or what is to be represented, signaling, if not a certain withholding, a willingness to cede a certain index of labor, of argument, or of authority to the shadow of that absent address. There is a certain economy in this overly familiar process, an acceptable shorthand that we readily employ. It, too, can be excessive at times. Among the seven deadly sins, one most often finds, looking up in a dictionary or an encyclopedia, a list. In that list, one most often finds acidia, sloth, in the very last place. Not quick, deficient in speed, slow, taking a long time to traverse a distance or to do a thing, gradual, not allowing or producing quick motion, tardy, reluctant, lingering, even dull-witted and stupid, deficient of interest, tedious, needful, immoderate. These are definitions found in the concise Oxford Dictionary, and a very similar list appears in Le Petit Robert and Collins' English-French dictionaries. However, the word whose definitions I've cited here is not acidia, or its usual rendering into English, sloth, but the word slow. My reason for doing this is to make salient a very long-standing relationship between the word slow and the word sloth, which has conveniently translated acidia. As English has evolved, the practice of adding the suffix th to nouns, or in some cases verb, has diminished, although the traces of certain of these modifications persist. For example, merry, mirth, foul, filth, young, youth, hail, health, and slow, sloth. In this form, its translation transports a great proportion of the meanings of slowness to the sense of acidia. In this sense, for example, I'll ad lib here a little bit, the notion of suddenness that you see written about so splendidly and eloquently by Hans Bohrer, in the book on suddenness as that flash of insight which accompanies the creation of works of art, literary works, even for that matter, think of Dr. Johnson or Baudelaire, good conversation. That rapidness is the precise opposite, counter-distinct to the slow and needful, dull and diminished sloth. No wonder it's a sin. And such slowness has a different configuration also in a modern context where words, utterances, presentations, performances are uttered, and in the very moment of their utterance are also reproduced, where transmission and production are simultaneous, coextensive. We would call this live, sort of like this is. Another section here. At the very beginning of a book entitled Ecographie de la Télévision, there's a citation, a remark having been made elsewhere, which is now coextensive with its appearance here. It begins with a bracketed ellipse, a diacritical convention marking an absence, and it goes like this. Today, more than ever before, to think one's time, especially when one takes the risk or the chance of speaking publicly about it, is to register in order to bring into play the fact that the time of this very speaking is artificially produced. It is an artifact. In its very happening, the time of this public gesture is calculated, constrained, formatted, initialized by a media apparatus. The words are those of Jacques Derrida, but they do not belong to him. And in fact, there is something that appears somewhat artificial in that claim and in the anxieties that are expressed here. Two philosophers, Jacques Derrida and Bernhard Stiegler, are improvising before a camera, talking about the effects of teletechnologies upon the philosophical and political moment. What is it to speak of a present moment within a situation of live recording, especially when what we have taken to be as natural conditions of expression, discussion, reflection, and negotiation have been breached, when in the very moment of their utterance, the words that one might speak, as a philosopher or a politician, are swept away, taken up in a transmission coextensive with the event of speech, that is to say, as artifacts. When these words are simultaneously produced and reproduced and distributed in a manner that is both plural and concrete, Walter Benjamin might use the word Massenweise, and massive, mass-like, we must conclude, as do Derrida and Stiegler, that, I quote, actuality is precisely made. In order to know what it is made of, one needs nonetheless to know that it is made. It is not given, but actively produced, sifted, invested, performatively interpreted by numerous apparatuses which are factious or artificial, hierarchizing and selective, always in the service of forces and interests to which subjects, you and I, and agents, us too, consumers and producers of actuality, sometimes philosophers and always interpreters, and us too, are never sensitive enough, no matter how singular, irreducible, stubborn, or distressing, or tragic the reality to which it refers. Actuality comes to us by way of a fictional fashioning. It can be analyzed only at the cost of a labor of resistance, of vigilant counterinterpretation. Stiegler and Derrida insist that one must never forget the full import and the full impact of this index. When a journalist, a politician, seems to be speaking to us in our homes, reading on a screen, at the dictation of a prompter, a text, composed somewhere else, at some other time, sometimes by others, or even by a whole network of anonymous authors, and so on and so on. Philosophers, Derrida and Stiegler. Sorry, this is actually a glitch in my screen. As you see, these moments, of course, infect and situate themselves throughout media all the time. In fact, the ending of my text is completely missing. I'll have to improvise once again. So, I'll ask, what consequences can accrue then to a situation when one word, speaking, as a philosopher or as an individual, are no longer your own, where the conditions of responsibility or obligation or ethics, as well as any performative configurations concerning truth, culpability, or mode of address, remain linked to a subjectivity which is dissipated and, while perhaps no less concrete, distributed, then it too has become phantasmatic, an appearance without substance, a shadow. The theorized speaking subject of only a few decades ago is an empty marker, a placeholder for a reality uncontained and uncontainable by its image, a deferred substantive, a kind of inversion of the pictoriality that Heidegger, in his later remarks on Technics, describes and decries as a danger, Gefahr, the modern world enframed by such things susceptible to being placed, subjects susceptible to being placed and displaced at will. A displacement now both constant and masked, contingent and conditional, ambient and susceptible, a cartography taking and holding place for an always absent referent. Every supplement bears the truth of an identity without even ever composing that identity. A passport, a credit card, a photograph, a license, a reputation, a rumor, even in this case a transmission, are linked to the possibility of the figure that appears as origin, a figure secured and stabilized within the prosthetics of an image as memory. It behooves us to not commit a sin of laziness, to be vigilant at all times to exactly what images, medias, mediations, and reproductions do. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks on sloth. Thank you.